Eat Drink Indiana Radio is brought to you by Eskenazi Health, one of Central Indiana's leading providers of health care. Eat Drink Indiana Radio is powered by EatDrinkIndy.com, where Central Indiana turns to learn about food from farm to fork and drink from grains to glass.
Welcome to Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI HD to the Point. I'm your host, Jolene Katzenberger. This week on Eat Drink Indiana Radio, we are talking cocktails and springtime. On the cocktail front, we'll be talking with local wine and spirits expert Arthur Black of the Indiana Craft Beverage Association about Mixture 2015, a new cocktail fest that will take place next month. And we'll hear from bartender Jason Faust of the North End Barbecue and Moonshine about some of his craft cocktails, including a house-made root beer and moonshine soda. And then we'll change the focus to springtime, and we'll head to Trader's Point Creamery's Loft Restaurant to check in with executive chef Brandon Canfield about favorite spring ingredients, menu changes, and using items foraged from the farm. So stay with us here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. So we are starting out this week talking about a new event for Indianapolis, a cocktail event or tour called Mixture that was created by the Indiana Craft Beverage Association, a recently formed not-for-profit. Local wine and spirits expert Arthur Black is heading up the ICBA, and I talked with him recently about how the idea for Mixture came about and what Indy's first cocktail fest will involve. So we have a cocktail fest this year, so tell me a little bit about what it is and what its name and how it all kind of came about.
That's pretty epic. It's not a simple endeavor, at least internally. Creating it, the mechanics are pretty crazy. We have five different wholesalers in town that have come together and are working with 40 different spirit sponsorships, 20 accounts, 2 days, a dozen plus breweries with the Indiana Brewers Guild, and then Georgia Street as well. So the city, it's a cocktail festival, but it's also a tour of downtown that has been created to kind of get Hoosiers excited about coming out, experiencing the various flavors of the various areas of downtown. So Wholesale District is the one of the participating areas with five accounts, and it's also the home of Georgia Street, which is where people arrive, they register, they acquire their passports, which showcase the different accounts that are involved in the two-day festival. And they can enjoy some Indiana breweries and some beer-based cocktails and some food on Georgia Street. And then they jump on transportation that we've secured, the brew bus people as well as the handlebar people. We're working with them. And you kind of cart around downtown. You go to Mass Ave. You get dropped off. You go to the participating accounts. You try their cocktails at those accounts. And then you go to Fletcher Place. And then you go to Fountain Square. And it's really just meant to get people out and experience the city.
Well, I think that's kind of a very cool idea. Now, this is all sort of came about from the Indiana Craft Beverage Association, right? And then you came up with this, with the idea for the cocktail festival called Mixture,
mm-hmm.
Right?
It's a mixture of areas, the four areas I mentioned. It's a mixture of wholesalers and suppliers, of beer and of spirits, and of various accounts. So Mixture just kind of came down to being a great name. The notion of the cocktail festival preceded the nonprofit, the ICBA. So certain persons in the community approached me about the possibility of creating a cocktail festival, which I've come to find out is not a small endeavor. At all.
So this has been a big project.
Yeah. But, you know, one, amazingly, though, that the inception was only about 16 months ago. So to come as far as we have and actually have something in place and to be able to rock this thing out on June 19th and 20th, it's impressive. After we came up with the notion of the nonprofit, all these other ideas have come into place. Websites with educational resources. We also do Repeal Day, which is the event on the latter half of the calendar, December 5th. which we work in large with the USBG, the Indiana chapter with. We're probably looking to create an Indianapolis cocktail trail with the city. So we got the cultural trail, we got the Monon trail, we have all these trails. Why not have a template of the downtown area that people visiting our city, when they check in at the Conrad or they check in at the JW, that they get handed this little map of the city that showcases all the different places to get various genres of beer, wine, cocktails, etc.
Well, sure, because we have wine trails in place. Mm-hmm. Why not cocktail trails, right? So what else can people expect? What's it gonna feel like downtown on Georgia Street when they come for this? There's going to be a lot going on.
There's a lot of activity. It's on a Friday and Saturday night, you know, so there should be activity downtown anyways. We have it planned with the calendar of downtown Indiana to where it's not, you know, in conflict with any major events. Georgia Street works out perfectly. It's an open venue area. There will be breweries there. We're hoping for about 15 to 20 breweries. They'll be pouring various selections and then also be pouring beer-based cocktails, so that people can appreciate this new phenomena of beer-based cocktails. We're going to have food vendors there. There's also live music. Parking is for Circle City Mall. So you arrive, you get onto Georgia Street, you register, you sign a waiver, you get your wristband, which is what's going to get you access to the transportation, the handlebar buses as well as the brew bus, and then you get that passport, and you can hang out on Georgia Street, or you can immediately jump onto one of the bikes and pedal your way to Mass Ave. Each area, Wholesale, Mass Ave, Fletcher Place, Fountain Square, Friday and Saturday night, they're assigned a different genre of alcohol. So Friday night's rum night on Mass Ave. So all 8 accounts on Mass Ave are going to be making rum-based cocktails. Saturday is bourbon, so on and so forth.
Well, that's kind of fun. So each area has different spirits each night?
Yep. Yeah, it's kind of a take on D.C. Cocktail Week. Like, they take a section of the city and every street, it becomes Vodka Street, Gin Street, Tequila Street. And then all week, you hit those accounts. I don't think we're big enough yet to sustain a full week, and we don't have that many accounts, but we do have 20 killer participating accounts in our 4 areas. So this is shaping up to be something unlike I've seen anywhere else in the country. It's different than Tales of the Cocktail. It's different than Portland Cocktail Week. It's completely unique, and it'll grow. The proceeds and the money that we make this year will go into an expo and trade portion next year. So this is Mixture Cocktail Tour, Indianapolis Cocktail Tour, Batch 2015 with Batch 2016. There'll be daytime educational seminars on, you know, beer-based cocktails or wine or spirits or whatever. We'll bring in talent. I most likely will be doing a couple seminars, I'm sure, probably about mezcal. You should assume that. Or sake or any number of things. And then we'll have a trade tasting. So it's really... it's a hybrid between consumer focus and trade focus. It's really a promotional endeavor to just highlight and celebrate all the different cool places downtown.
Well, I think maybe people might not realize how many cool places there are that are doing, you know, quality cocktails. I mean, it's really been growing.
There's never been a more exciting landscape. We have 20 accounts. So if you look at our website, indiemixture.com, and you go to, you know, participating accounts, at 20 different accounts in 4 areas are participating. And we had a lot of other accounts that were interested and said, you know, we want to partake too.
So this is 20 different cocktail bars and restaurants, right?
Mm-hmm. Cocktail focused, uh-huh. Yeah, by and large. I mean, there are certain places that are really just cocktails. And then there are other places that are restaurants. So, you know, Bluebeard, obvious, you know, restaurant, great beverage program on all sides. But, you know, they do some really remarkable cocktails. Just across the street in Fletcher Place is Hotel Tango, so a new place that is really just cocktails. And then, you know, Milktooth is participating too. So at Fletcher Place alone, you know, we got a breakfast place, a restaurant place, and a distillery. So again, it's a mixture of all these different elements of the city. But the one common thing that they all share is a genuine desire to provide great beverage programming to the city. So we're excited. We've never seen more engaged people and purveyors of quality service and food and beverage.
We've been talking with Arthur Black of the Indiana Craft Beverage Association. For information on the group and its upcoming event Mixture, go to indiemixture.com. Well, along with Indy's growing food culture has come a burgeoning cocktail culture as well. And the local interest in craft cocktails has led to a new festival called Mixture, which will take place June 19th and 20th downtown. But just how did the local cocktail scene grow enough to support a festival? Wine and spirits expert Arthur Black tells us how it all came about and explains a few more details about Mixture, the new cocktail fest created by the Indiana Craft Beverage Association.
Well, let's talk a little bit about how the city has developed as far as spirits, you know, and cocktail programs. It's really changed in certainly the last 5 years. Do you think, has there been a, can you mark, you know, when this interest really started to develop?
Giving all due respect to all of our accounts throughout the city and state who have been, you know, pushing and fighting all along and have always done a great job, we have had an explosion of new accounts, chefs that have worked under chefs that have worked under chefs that have gone off and opened up their new places. And we have a lot more service professionals in town that appreciate recognizing you should know about wine, you should know about beer, you should know about cocktails. It is the cocktail element between those things that I think has kind of started to really shine in the past 5 years. We have 20 accounts. You know, I mean, I never would have thought of being able to pull something like this off 5 years ago. And there were a couple of people a couple of years ago when we were thinking about this that were like, we're still not ready. There's nothing to it but to do it. I mean, I think the city's ready for it. I think it's going to blow up. The notion of cocktails in Indianapolis is making us a destination city.
What does it take, you know, to become a destination city as far as cocktails? It has to be more than just the numbers, right? There has to be, you know, some, you know, interest and education and growth there in, you know, in the service community. We've had a lot of people participating in contests, you know, in competitions. So it seems like the interest is there, you know, in the service industry as well as in the consumers too.
A huge part of this is trying to get, you know, there's that trickle-down theory. Like if wholesalers and suppliers and educators like myself and others in the city, if we're working and doing our jobs and spreading the gospel of alcohol enthusiasm and embracing and knowing about beverage programming, that goes to the retail element, whether it's on-premise, off-premise. And these accounts become destination places because they have people in place who have credibility and consumers trust what they're selling, what they're talking about, this particular wine, this particular spirit, this particular cocktail. The more the retail element appreciates that, the more it trickles down to consumers becoming aware. We need to get other people to appreciate that you don't have to go to Chicago to get a great meal anymore. You don't have to go to either coast. You don't need to fly over Indianapolis to get to someplace cool to eat and drink. You can do it right here. And by and large, you can do it with a hell of a lot more humility and genuine character and more modest price points, because that's, you know, it's something that Indiana has. We have people that are genuine and, you know, very relaxed and have humility, and that's one of the reasons why I've stayed here over the years.
How do you see the consumer developing? Has the interest there, you know, come along as well?
Slowly. You know, arguably not the rate that I would prefer, but it has come along. You know, it's 5 years ago, you didn't have the amount of selection that you have now today, whether it was wine programming, whether it were spirit options, things like mezcal being embraced by consumers at large, vermouths and amaros. You know, we have accounts now that pour Fernet Branca on tap. I mean, that's insane. And they wouldn't do it if it wasn't sustainable, unless, of course, we're assuming that the local bartending community is drinking all of that Fernet Branca, which could be possible. But it's slow. It's baby steps. You know, it's you have to slowly, you know, get more interesting product that's more esoteric into a marketplace, and you cultivate that consumer demand for it. And I think we're doing a great job at it. I don't think there's ever been a more exciting time for consumers and or retailers and wholesalers and suppliers in Indiana.
Where do you see it going from here? Do you think we can sustain the growth and keep going and push the sort of cocktail community further?
There is a question of sustainability. It's, again, the trade knows how awesome some of the accounts are, many of the accounts are throughout Indianapolis and Indiana. We need to make sure we're not closing doors as we're opening them, because there's no shortage of doors opening. We've had so many new accounts that have opened up over the past several years, and Downtown Indy is doing a great job of promoting downtown, and downtown is really, really blown up. But, you know, there are only so many consumers unless we cultivate and grow that demographic that can appreciate going out and having a cocktail at this venue before they go to another venue down the street and have appetizers and then go to another venue down the street and have a meal. When you buy a ticket for $50, you get access to Georgia Street, you get access to the transportation element, and then you go to one of these accounts and you get a sample of the cocktail they're making of rum on Friday night or, you know, bourbon on Saturday night, and then you're supposed to leave. You know, you're not supposed to hang out at Black Market or Ball and Biscuit all night. You're supposed to try the sample and then go down the street to the next place. So get out and walk around, experience the city the way that we want, you know, people to do consistently throughout the calendar year. Get out and walk around.
Tell me where people can get some more information about it or buy tickets. Tickets are already available, right?
Tickets are on sale. IndyMixture.com is the website. It's active. It's live. Go to the account. You can see the participating accounts. You can see all the different supplier sponsorships. We have amazing brands that are participating. So a brand will occupy a certain venue the evening of Friday or Saturday, and they'll be making that genre assigned to that area of that brand, and you get a sample of it. Friday night is $50. Saturday night is $50. If you do both nights, it's dropped down to $85. Yeah, so we would recommend, you know, this is not like a race. You can't complete this tour. It's impossible. It's between 5:30 and 10 o'clock. You can't hit 20 accounts in that time. So, you know, Friday night, if you like bourbon, then, you know, you should go to the wholesale district and visit those accounts and spend time on Georgia Street. If you like gin, then go to Fletcher Place and then go to Fountain Square afterwards if you like agave and tequila and mezcal and things like that. And then Saturday night, you spend time on Mass Ave. So stretch it out between Friday and Saturday. But mind you, we're only selling so many seats to this. So there's a limit.
So people need to get their tickets, because this could sell out, right?
We're expecting it to sell out very soon. There's only 600 spots Friday night and Saturday night. We wanted to keep traffic at individual accounts relatively down. We wanted to do this right the first year rather than sell out thousands of tickets, because with certain organizations we were working with, they're like, man, you could sell thousands. And it's, well, maybe one day, maybe mixture batch 2017, 2018. Well, if we can figure out the mechanics. But this isn't supposed to be a burden on the accounts participating. We wanted the accounts participating to be excited, and we want the people participating, those attending, to be excited. Just, it's a tour of the city. You go out, you enjoy the evening, you pedal around on bikes, you try samples of cocktails. If you want to get appetizers or dinner or whatever at these accounts while you're there, by all means, but that does come out of your own pocket. The $50 gets you access to Georgia Street, the transportation element, and then samplings of the cocktails. And you're not getting like a Dixie cup sample, you know, but you're also not getting a mug. You know, we got to be somewhat responsible. You are getting an appropriate high quality cocktail at each account that you go to. And we strongly recommend you stretch it out over Friday and Saturday night and not just try and hit it all in one night.
We've been talking with Arthur Black of the Indiana Craft Beverage Association about Mixture, a cocktail fest that takes place downtown June 19th and 20th. For information and tickets, go to IndyMixture.com. Eat Drink Indiana Radio is made possible with support from Eskenazi Health, providing care to nearly 1 million outpatient visitors each year with the mission to advocate, care, teach, and serve at its hospital and inpatient facility and 11 community health centers located throughout Indianapolis. EskenaziHealth.edu. Sometimes here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio, story ideas are sparked by something I read, and one of this week's cocktail interviews was prompted by a recent headline I saw. Is root beer the new tonic? Well, now that was intriguing. So that led to a question about root beer that I posted on Facebook. And if you're not following the great conversations I have with folks in the local food community on Facebook, well, you should be. Which led to learning about the house-made root beer that bartender Jason Faust uses for his moonshine soda at the North End Barbecue and Moonshine. So I had to stop in at the North End recently to talk about root beer and moonshine, and I even got a tip about a root beer float. So root beer, right? Yeah. So tell me what you're doing here at the North End Barbecue and Moonshine,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Well, it started out with the moonshine. Moonshine's in our name. So, and you know, we were doing moonshine punch, and we've got this great array of moonshine, some locally, but the rest from all over the country. And they've done surprisingly well, and not knowing what's going to happen, because there's still this mystique with moonshine and how it's made and what it is, and people that think that we actually make it. And
So now tell me again what it is, because you're not making moonshine in the back, right?
Correct. Yeah. Maybe, you know, who knows? Maybe eventually. But right, it's essentially just an unaged spirit. Most of it's 100% corn whiskey. Years and years ago, when Prohibition, people actually would just use sugar because sugar's fermentable. So they would just literally be a spirit made from sugar and water. But most of it's corn-based, but it's 100% corn whiskey. And most all of them up there are. There's a couple of neutral grain ones that are pretty hot. But this particular one, So we thought moonshine. Well, this, you know, there's something to this. We liked it because it fits with barbecue and whiskey, and it is, you know, it's become popular. But to take that one step further, we started doing the punch, and then I started trying to think of ways to incorporate it even more. And I thought, well, let's try to make some just tip sodas with moonshine.
Now the punch was really a big hit, right?
A huge hit, totally unexpected. Again, just with moonshine, I thought people just would be afraid of it. But it's our number one seller, and it has been since for almost a year now since we've opened.
So how much moonshine punch do you make typically?
We usually start off the night with 2 gallons, probably a night, and that's on the weekends we'll go through sometimes 4 gallons.
I think that's great.
Yeah, and it's great because it's easy for us because we just batch it and it's ready to go, and we can just pour and shake it up, and we have fun with it. We flavor it. You know, we don't have any flavors really. We infuse this with some peach and ginger, but otherwise it's just all neutral.
So then from there you decide to go with the sodas, right? So
yeah.
and root beer and what else are you doing?
So we started with these sodas. We started with a root beer and a tropical punch. So, why not, right? I started to think of sodas and things I liked and popular flavors and things that I thought could mask moonshine flavor. So we started with those two. We want to expand it into grape and lemonade and cream soda are the next ones on the plate. And then we'll just kind of keep going and start messing with our own. But for now, we're doing the root beer, which is by far the most popular. And some of the servers have started to sell it with ice cream and doing an adult root beer float.
Oh, man, and that sounds really good.
Yeah. And so it's a moonshine root beer float, and so that's been really popular. But the root beer, the tropical punch, we started with a mixture of just spirits and liqueurs, and it wasn't quite cost-effective, so I actually found a kind of a tropical fruit base. So I cheat a little bit on that one, I guess. But we add a little orange liqueur and some other things to it to doctor it up a little bit. But then the root beer, like I said, we've got our base of 8 herbs and molasses. And
So you're making the root beer. I mean, it's right here, and it smells so good. But how do you make the root beer base?
So it starts with, and I've tweaked several recipes. I should just keep it the same because the one is fantastic. But this batch, we've got sarsaparilla, sarsaparilla, burdock, licorice root, yellow dock, which is something new to me. I found some recipes, some old kind of birch beer recipes I called for it, so I thought I'd give it a try. But sassafras in the main ingredients, and then some vanilla, molasses. But I'll start with all those herbs and just slowly boil it for about a 45 minutes, an hour with it with water. Then I'll filter it all out. Mix in, I'll use a combination of molasses and raw sugarcane sugar. And so I feel like it creates a nice consistency for base syrup. And then I'll bring that mixture back to the boil when it's after it's boiled, after it's hot again and filtered. Mix in the sugar and let it set. And I've got my syrup base. So then I'll add the moonshine to it. We have this root liqueur. It's an organic line of organic liqueurs. It's a nice bitter liqueur to cut through the sweetness a little bit. And the moonshine, actually, that we started using is a spiced moonshine from this company called Cat Daddy.
I bet that goes really well with all the flavors of the root beer, right?
Well, and that's what dawned on me the first time. And I ended up trying it with the fruit punch, and it was fantastic. And I think it's subtle enough that it just blends in but adds some depth to the sodas. And then just Cat Daddy Moonshine, and we'll put it in a container and then carbonate it with our fancy carbonation rig here, and then bottle it and cap it individually, and then we've got our little 187 champagne, I guess, size.
So you got actually little bottles that you would have to open with for people when they order it. Does it come in the little bottles like that?
Yep, and we'll present it with a ball jar and ice. And at table side, we'll bring it to the table with the ball jar and ice and pop it and pour it right there in front of them. And they've got tastes like a boozy root beer.
People are willing to try this kind of stuff?
Yeah, and I think it's a way to, for those people that are still a little timid, for them to try it and to say, try it in this root beer. Because it's one, you can tell there's alcohol in there, but it's not going to kick you, slap you in the face, and the moonshine itself isn't that high proof. It's about the same as most vodkas, so it's not going to kick you in the butt, even if you drink one. So I think it's a way to say moonshine's not that bad. It's not the stuff that the mystery bottle that might have been in your grandpa's fridge.
We've been talking with Jason Faust of the North End Barbecue and Moonshine and Late Harvest Kitchen. Check out those restaurants' cocktail menus at thenorthendbbq.com and lateharvestkitchen.com. When it comes to exploring the growing craft cocktail scene in Indianapolis, it can be a little overwhelming just because there are so many options. For example, at the North End Barbecue and Moonshine, Jason Faust has 200 whiskeys on the drinks menu, along with plenty of cool cocktails, house-made moonshine sodas, and a seasonally changing shake-up, all of which have proved popular with customers. I talked with Jason recently about what's happening locally and what he's up to at the North End. So tell me about the sort of seasonality that you have going on the bar menu, or the liquid catalog, yes, as the menu says. That's great.
Yeah, we're with barbecue and just the feeling of being outdoors and outside, and trying to tie in seasonality with that, not only with the kitchen but the drink menu. We always have a seasonal shake-up on the menu, and it'll change with what fruit's in season.
Like a lemon shake-up,
yeah,
right?
Oh, yeah. So the idea is to have a lemon shake-up, but just incorporate fruit. So you think of that crisp, just fresh lemon, because we always use fresh juices here. But to use that lemon shake-up base, so some fresh sugar, fresh pressed lemon juice, and whatever fruit. We started with the strawberry basil. We moved in this winter. We moved into a spiced pear.
That sounds great, too.
Yeah, that was really good. And this one, I think, is my favorite. It's blackberry and thyme.
Oh, my God.
So we'll use a thyme syrup with fresh blackberry. We use a little bit of raspberry, too, in there for a little bit of color, really. And then, like I said, that lemon shake-up base and vodka. And it's got a booze in there, right?
So now is that? I bet that's a big hit, too.
Yep, that's probably one of our top one of our top three. The Moonshine Punch, the seasonal shake-up, and then we have a Texas Mule. It's a riff on a Moscow Mule. We use Tito's vodka from Texas. We use habanero bitters and some chipotle-infused agave nectar.
Oh, that's the spicy one. That's right. I've had that, too. That's really good.
Yeah, you have. That's right. And so those three are by far top favorites. And then we've got a couple new ones that we added on, a few more whiskey drinks just to It's another vodka is always the number one seller.
Is it really?
Yeah, it still is, and which is great if it gets them into drinking some unique cocktails. But now I think the whiskey ones are really coming on, and we've added a couple more, and using some geekier stuff that we like to use. Like we've got a whiskey drink infused with Earl Grey tea, and using a raspberry shrub. That's really good. Yeah, and another great summer drink. And
so now tell me about the whiskeys. I mean, you have so many whiskeys. Yes. You got the sign outside, 200?
200 strong and growing. We've slowly accumulated an army back there, but it's fun, and we've got an ongoing commitment to education with the staff, and you know, they can talk you through the menu and they can talk background on the styles. But at the same time, we're trying to offer as much as we can just on our own. So with this new liquid catalog, we're you know, adding the distilleries and separating the whiskeys by style, like bonded and single barrel and wheat and rye, and just to give a little more education for you if you're just sitting at the table, if some people don't like to ask. But just to put things in perspective, when you look into it, you realize that a ton of these whiskeys all come from just a handful of distilleries. Right. But
It's certainly a lot. This is great. I you know, you have the glossary and everything. Yeah. So that I think that's helpful, you know?
Because I think a lot of people still don't know what bourbon is or what's the difference between bourbon and whiskey, and does bourbon have to be from Kentucky? And it doesn't, by the way. But
but that's one of those misconceptions,
yeah,
right?
Absolutely. So those little, you know, fun talk tracks that we can talk about, but, you know, hopefully open people's eyes a little bit by them just coming in and sitting down at the table. We're coming on almost a year, which is right. Unbelievable. But, you know, the more people, the more the word gets out. And, you know, we're fortunate enough to get voted the best bourbon bar by the monthly. And that's helped. And it's brought people in, and they just kind of look. And some people are just, you know, where do I even start? You know, but yeah, they, you know, now we're seeing more of the Scotch drinkers and more of the drinkers that they want to learn, and they want to see, you know, they hear about it, and it's a huge fad. So they just want to come in and check it out.
So where do you start with somebody like that who maybe your vodka drinker or something, you know, who doesn't know where to start?
That's a great question. It seems to be coming up a lot more because they'll say just that. I want to try it, but I don't know. What do I do? And that we have a handful, I feel like, we go to that are a little more mild, a little more maybe buttery, we like to call it, that a little more approachable to sip, lower proof, of mm-hmm. course. We've got a couple... That a French one, for example.
I think that I was just going to ask about the French one. I tried it at the Whiskey Expo year before last, and it was like, oh my gosh, this is a French, you know, because it was kind of floral.
Yes,
you know?
Absolutely. And there, a lot of the international whiskeys, like Irish, does it a lot, but they'll finish it in sherry barrels or port wine barrels. So you have a little bit, like, definitely a floral note to it, but then you'll have some added sweetness, so it's easier to drink. And I think it's a great way to say, well, try this and see what you think. There's some others we have, like, I'm trying to think, that are approachable, not quite as hot. Again, there's so many, I don't know where to start. But, you know, like a big name, Basil Hayden is one that I think's approachable and smooth and easy to drink. But then, you know, we've got a ton of ryes, and ryes are traditionally a little spicier, a little hotter. But
very popular right now.
Yeah, very popular, especially with all the rise of the craft cocktails. But I think the geeks are really gravitating towards those single barrels and the barrel strength, they call them, where they don't really dilute them as much. They're higher proof, they have more bite, but they're a little more representation of the whiskey as it came out of the barrel. So the geeks are gravitating towards those whiskeys, but those aren't the whiskeys that you want to give to somebody that is just trying out, right. You know. But we've got the bourbons are really the ones that they should try, because the bourbons are traditionally the way you get more of those caramel and vanilla notes, and I think are a little easier to drink.
So somebody could just come in and just sort of say that they just wanted to try something, you know, and you would, you know, pick out something for them, right?
Yes, and that's usually what happens. We'll say, well, you know, do you trust me? And just and find something that, again, it's really just, I feel like each bartender has their own couple go-tos, if you will, but they all seem to always work. And Johnny Drum, for example, is one of mine that just, it's not really, it's a little off the beaten path, but it's inexpensive if you can find it in the store, but it's one that is nice and easy to drink, and a couple cubes or a little bit of water in it. It's really, really good.
We've been talking with Jason Faust of the North End Barbecue and Moonshine.
Check out his cocktails and those 200 whiskeys at thenorthendbbq.com. Eat Drink Indiana Radio is made possible with support from Eskenazi Health. With its 315-bed hospital and inpatient facilities and 11 community health centers located throughout Indianapolis. EskenaziHealth.edu. Well, it's definitely springtime in Indianapolis, and we've got the great weather and gorgeous flowering trees to prove it. But we've also got a city full of creative chefs who are busy adding springtime ingredients to local menus. To soak up some of the beautiful weather and talk springtime ingredients, I headed to Trader's Point Creamery recently, where Brandon Canfield, executive chef at the Loft Restaurant, is busy adding items to the menu from the restaurant's garden. We talked this week about seasonal ingredients, menu inspiration, and what's growing in the garden. It's springtime, and you have this wonderful farm out here, and you have a garden that you have planned throughout the winter, so you have lots of product to work with, and I assume lots of things coming on the agenda for spring. So tell me a little bit about the spring menus and what you're thinking about, and the garden, and how you, all sorts of things.
So last year, we began the garden as the project that it is now. Darren, the gardener, was the first year. We were kind of running behind getting things going. So this year we've had all winter to plan, and it's been really nice because we can kind of space out the plantings and the harvestings now. So we've got a constant supply of whatever vegetable that it is we want throughout the season. So exciting things coming on are, for me, is lettuce. I can't stand bagged lettuce. The plastic bagged lettuce, it tastes like nothing, and it's already garbage by the time you get it. Plus, it probably comes from California or something like that. So that's very exciting for me, just to have this kind of green salad in my backyard as a chef. So we've got a new plan for that as far as the harvesting and the kind of storage on the back end of lettuce. So it's going to be a really cool thing. And always radishes are nice for me. Kind of shows the sign of spring, first really harvestable vegetable that you can get. Oh, sure. It's got some substance to it.
Oh, you know, crisp and big taste, you know. Absolutely. and it kind of speaks of spring. Absolutely. Doesn't it?
Also sorrel. We've got the old school variety of sorrel. It's the all green variety, and I've really grown to love it because, I mean, there's classic French dishes with sorrel sauce and sure. Salmon. You know, hugely classic, but it to me provides this brightness and this kind of bracing acidity in something that's not a citrus. So it's, you can get this nice pop of brightness on the palate, but it comes from a green vegetable. It comes from a leaf, and I enjoy that. So that's fun. We make all sorts of, you know, pestos and sauces, and add it to the salads and garnishes with that.
So when you're thinking of things, you know, that you're going to have in a garden that are coming on in the spring, and you were probably thinking about this last fall and winter when you were planning out the garden, how do you think about that? Do you think about mostly timing or what you want, or there are probably things that grow better here than they do in other places?
True. I at a certain point, you've got to kind of, well, I think at most points, you've got to just be able to accept what the garden's willing to give you and what's growing at that time. So if it's not time for carrots, it's not time for carrots. And, you know, that's true kind of cooking from the garden, farm to table, seasonality thing that we're, you know, all trying to strive towards. But looking towards, looking from the planning perspective in the winter, into the seasons, there's definitely a plan as to what is going to come up first and how those are going to be used on the menu. So, like I said, I've got lettuces, I've got radishes, I've got baby carrots, we've got sorrel out there right now, and some strawberry patches that are few years old and should be producing this really nice fruit for quite a few weeks. But the, you know, that's further down in the summertime. So there is a rhyme and reason to the planning part in the winter, as far as what goes on the menu in the spring and summer and fall.
So what kind of things can people be looking forward to, you know, as far as the menu goes? You know, if, do you have specific dishes in mind? Are things coming on out of the garden and going onto the menu right now?
Right now, it's mostly early herbs. And then we're actually, a lot of the things we're getting are not necessarily from the garden that we're using. A lot of these are foraged from the property.
That's really cool. So tell me a little bit about that. Are you, so you're actually, I mean, you have a lot of land out here, you know, at Trader's Point Creamery. So do you actually go out, you're going out and looking for specific things?
So, yes. So, like I said, Darren's the gardener, and he's, you've got some downtime, you know, before the garden actually, things can go into the ground. So he's busy doing starts, and he's got little seedlings and things like that in the hoop house ready to go in. But in the meantime, I think it was 2 weeks ago, maybe we went out and we were walking around and we found a huge patch of trout lilies. We've got spring beauty flowers. We've got toothwort. We have Virginia waterleaf, stinging nettles. And the last one's garlic mustard, which is an invasive species, but it's got a wonderful flavor. So some of these things go, they go into our spring green salad. We get trout lily flowers and some little garlic mustard blossoms and flowers from spring beauties. And then the other ones go into like a braised green dish.
Oh, that's very nice. You know, I was walking through the woods the other day and I did see those trout lilies. At the time, I didn't know what they were. I had to come back, you know, and figure out what they were. So those little, the beautiful little flowers can go into, I mean, you can eat those. I guess maybe I didn't know that. So.
Yes, you can eat those. We've done, you know, Darren's got done a huge amount of research, and I've got a couple kind of well-known foragers from around the area here that have helped out with identifying and making sure we're doing, you know, eating the right thing. My sous chef brought in a cookbook about, her name's Marion Kluger, and she's got one or two cookbooks about living kind of off the land and harvesting these things and how to utilize these products throughout the year. So we've been, you know, using those old cookbooks as reference.
Oh, that's very fun. Now, from there, where do you go when you're thinking about dishes? Does your ideas come from research, or do they come from the ingredients? You know, what kind of drives your creative process?
That's a good question. I think it depends on the day. It really does, because sometimes I'll be skimming through something old that I've looked at hundreds of times, and I'll see something new in that I've never noticed before. So, and that could spark something. It's, you know, I look at writers, I think, for inspiration, and some of the tools that writers use for their creativity and creative process. So one of the tools that I've learned about is you start off with any sentence from the first half of any sentence from any book, some novel or whatever you want to write. And then you keep progressing from there and you create your story based on that first sentence. So a dish might occur out of one ingredient, sunchokes, for example. So we had sunchokes growing in the garden last year, and it's another great, another phenomenal vegetable. I absolutely adore sunchokes, not only because of their flavor and everything, but they can be stored over winter. So we just actually used the last of our sunchokes from last winter. And this dish was inspired by the last of the sunchokes from last year. So that was the starting point for that dish. Now it's what protein do I want to go with that dish? I've got two poultries on the menu already, so that kind of limits that. I've got a couple fish items already, so I ended up with venison. And or we could have done rabbit. So venison or rabbit was one of the two options, and we just went with venison. Wanted another red meat for the time. So you've got sunchokes and venison and all of these foraged greens from the farm. So there's foraged greens braised down with ramps and sauce made from wild green onions and a nice little salad of the foraged greens as well, the fresh foraged greens. So that's how, for instance, the last week's menu item came about.
We've been talking with Chef Brandon Canfield of the Trader's Point Creamery's Loft Restaurant. You can check out what's happening on the farm and what's cooking in the kitchen at tpforganics.com. When it comes to using locally raised ingredients, it doesn't get much more local than animals raised right outside the kitchen window, which is exactly what's happening at the Loft Restaurant at Trader's Point Creamery. I talked recently with the Loft's chef, Brandon Canfield, about what's being raised on the farm, in addition to all those dairy cows. Now, here at Trader's Point Creamery, you have really good dairy products. So, of course, you're known for the yogurt, the cheese, the milk. Are you always incorporating that into your menu as well? Thinking of the product that comes, right from the farm?
Absolutely. There's a lot of things that I get from the farm. So, like you said, I've got the dairy, I've got the milk, the yogurt, the cheese, fresh cheeses, aged cheeses. Also, the pigs, the chickens, the garden. There's so many things that come from this land that I get the honor to use. I'm fortunate to have all of these at my fingertips. So there is definitely a dedicated effort to utilize everything, and it's kind of the same. It's the same as it is with using the whole pigs that we get from here. I use all of the cheeses that we make here, and I use the yogurt, and there's not one thing that's produced under the umbrella of Trader's Point Creamery that we don't use in the kitchen.
Tell me a little bit about the pigs that you're raising out here, because we're very familiar with the dairy cows, mm-hmm. And the yogurt and the award-winning yogurts and cheeses and that sort of thing, and maybe we're less familiar with the animals, the other animals that are raised out here.
Well, this is, I'm not personally raising them.
Well, I think you have other things to do, right?
But, we've got a phenomenal farm staff here, a few guys that take care of all of the pastures, and they take care of the dairy herd with all the milking, and all that livestock that, takes up, milking's twice a day, and it's just constant, never ending. But in their spare time, they've decided to raise hogs. And we've got, I'm not sure how many we have now. I think they're in the teens right now that are growing. So it's unlike anything that I've ever experienced before as a chef, is to be able to sit down and talk to the person who raises the meat that you're going to use, raising it, a few hundred feet away from the kitchen. And we save, we save all our trimmings from the kitchen, and those either go to the hogs, or they go sometimes to the chickens, or they go to, it's greens and stuff, we'll go to compost back into the garden. So that ability to have the source of your food so close is something that you can't really fake that. You can't, yes, I know a lot of people who raise animals and they do a phenomenal job, but I can walk down between shifts and see these animals growing and see these animals being raised and how they're doing and if they're, how big they are and if they're getting, if they're nice and healthy, which they are. So, that's a wonderful, it's an amazing experience. I mean, who wouldn't love that?
And it's unusual, because there aren't all that many restaurants that are right on a farm where the product is actually being raised, right outside the window.
Right. And that, it allows for me, it allows constant feedback and communication with the guys that are doing it. So, we're bringing up eggs, and if the shells are weak and the eggs break really too easily, I can say, hey, this is what's happening. And they'll look and say, oh, they you know, we can probably adjust this or adjust that, and it'll work. Same thing with the hog. So I think it's our second or third round that we've got out now, and we're serving off of the last batch. So I can come to them and say, you know, this group of hogs, this group of pigs, it tastes different than the last batch. You know, what is different? Are they getting more whey from the byproduct of the cheese making process? Are they eating less? Was it a different breed? Are they older? Are they younger? Was it, you know, actually the slaughterhouse that was different? So having that kind of intimate interaction with the guys who are raising it, you know, at the end of the day, every time, every step, every time we do this again, they're going to be huge steps forward into us both getting what we want, what we can do best. So the hogs that are coming to me now are better than the ones that were from the last batch. And same thing with the garden. So it's just, that's the real beauty of it, is being so close and having so much interaction with myself and my kitchen staff and the farmers and the gardener, and everybody's very, very close and we work together.
We've been talking with Chef Brandon Canfield of the Loft Restaurant at Trader's Point Creamery. For more information on the farm, its award-winning yogurts and cheeses, and the restaurant's menu, go to tpforganics.com. You've been listening to Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI HD2 The Point. I'm your host, Jolene Ketzenberger. Thanks for tuning in this week, and thanks also to our guests, Arthur Black of the Indiana Craft Beverage Association, Jason Faust of the North End Barbecue and Moonshine, and Chef Brandon Canfield of Trader's Point Creamery's Loft Restaurant. And thanks also to producer John Ketzenberger for helping to bring you Eat Drink Indiana Radio.
Eat Drink Indiana Radio is brought to you by Eskenazi Health, one of Central Indiana's leading providers of health care. Eat Drink Indiana Radio is powered by EatDrinkIndy.com, where Central Indiana turns to learn about food from farm to fork and drink from grains to glass.